Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the path forward following the release of the Mueller report, which nobody has read except for those who compiled it, as well as the Attorney General, who has done a clean-up job for the White House, burying the incriminating evidence in the report while distorting its findings to shape the public's perceptions in favor of Trump. David Rothkopf, a visiting professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, joins us to discuss how Trump, who has been one step ahead of the sheriff throughout his life, appears to have dodged another bullet. And thanks to Barr's tenacious cover-up, there is no way forward for the Congress in terms of impeachment unless and until they have the complete report containing the most damning information, evidence, and leads. And now as the focus moves from the legal to the political arena, we'll assess what are the strongest elements of the case against Trump, which appear to come from efforts by those close to Trump, like his White House counsel, who refused to carry out the president's orders and do what Don McGahn called crazy SH bleep. And now that all the adults have been purged from the White House and that Trump only listens to Stephen Miller and Steve Bannon, the question arises, who will pry Trump's fingers from the nuclear button? Then we'll look into the strongest evidence in the Mueller report revealing the Trump campaign's collusion with the Russians and speak with Anders Asland, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and a professor at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and author of the new book, Russia's Crony Capitalism. A former Swedish diplomat who served in Moscow and Kiev, he joins us to discuss Paul Manafort's blatant collusion with the Russian military intelligence operative Konstantin Kalimnik, as well as today's elections in Ukraine, where a comedian has won the presidency. Then finally, we'll assess the legal absurdity of having the highly touted great prosecutor Robert Mueller and his crack team spend 22 months investigating someone who, at the end of the day, they cannot indict. Aziz Haque, a professor of law at the University of Chicago and co-author of How to Save a Constitutional Democracy, joins us to discuss what appears to be Mueller's intention, in spite of having his report intercepted by Barr, for the Congress to follow up on the work that he has done, however inconclusive it might appear to be from what we've been able to see of it so far. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, a visiting professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's been a longtime contributor to Foreign Policy Magazine and was the CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group from 2012 to 2017. And his latest book is The Great Questions of Tomorrow. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Hi.
Well, David, you've written so much about the government and the power centers in this country with Power Incorporated, the epic rivalry between big business and government, and the reckoning and superclass, the global power elite and the world they're making and running the world, the inside story of the National Security Council, and national insecurity, American leadership in an age of fear. So as a student of power centers and the presidency and how the White House operates, do you think the founding fathers were ever prepared for somebody like Donald Trump, who appears to be a career criminal and possibly a traitor?
I don't think they anticipated anybody like Trump, but they were prepared for it. If you look at the Constitution, it mentions impeachment seven times. It does contain provisions by which a president can be removed from office. And certainly the founding fathers wrote about situations in which individuals accrued power and then abused it and the risks associated with that. And in fact, the core principle of the establishment of the United States government was that no individual should be above the law, as kings had been, and that we would be a nation of laws. And we now find ourselves in a situation where the president of the United States has attempted to place himself above the law. He has done so repeatedly. His cabinet has done so repeatedly. And the rule of law of the United States is at risk. The Constitution is clear in what the response to that must be, which is the impeachment of the president. It's not purely a political matter. It's a matter of duty to the Constitution and duty to the rule of law in the United States. I believe that ultimately the evidence, which is contained even just in the redacted version of the Mueller report, is compelling enough to obligate the House of Representatives to undertake impeachment hearings.
But do you think it's compelling enough for the American public to recognize the kind of person they have in the White House, the only Republican senator that's spoken out honestly about what the report indicates, which is that this man, and not that this is in any news, that Trump is both, temperamentally and morally unfit to be president of the United States, not to mention the fact that he is obviously totally lacking in judgment. If all of his aides have to stop or sabotage or slip aside all of his orders, and one of them, not just McCann, but if Corey Lewandowski refused to carry out Trump's orders, you better believe that there's some crazy you-know-what going on in that place.
Yeah, because Corey Lewandowski is a pig, and he's behaved himself in an atrocious way. And, the only reason Don McGahn stayed in the government was because his objective was to put in place right-wing judges that he, as part of the Federalist Society, had sought to put in place for a long time, which, in fact, is in and of itself an effort to undermine the rule of law. And so a number of the people who are heroes of this report are not heroes in any way, in terms of the United States of America. Having said that, we do have a divided country, but that's really not the issue here. This is not a political issue, although that's a part of its context. This is an issue in which an individual is systematically working to undermine the rule of law, and it's not just what's in the Mueller report. Steve Mnuchin ignored his obligation under the law to provide the taxes of Trump to the president. The Commerce Secretary lied to the Congress in his effort to change the census and put sort of racist components within the census. The president's son and others lied to the Congress repeatedly. The president told members of his Department of Homeland Security to violate the law and came up with strategies for them to deal with judges if judges made it harder for them to violate the law. The list is long. The crimes are manifold. They're a matter of public record. And that's quite apart from the fact that there's a national security imperative here. The president of the United States cooperated with, embraced, defended, took advantage of, and later rewarded the intervention in the United States elections of an enemy of the United States, an enemy that reached out and contacted over 100 million Americans during the course of the election, an enemy that was guided to battleground states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin by members of the Trump campaign, including specifically Paul Manafort per the Mueller report. And that enemy sought to influence the election in places where the ultimate margin of victory of the president of the United States was something like 77,000 votes in over those three battleground states. And by the way, as recently as today, the day that we are taping this, the president's counsel, Rudy Giuliani, when questioned on Meet the Press about whether it was wrong to take stolen information from the Russians and use it to win, said, well, it depends on what kind of information. I mean, this is mind-boggling. It is not perhaps rising to the legal definition of the word treason, but it is certainly traitorous. It's a betrayal of the United States. And so, some things rise above politics in this country, and even if 40% of the American people continue to support Donald Trump, there is an obligation to the Democrats who control the House, and frankly to any Republican who would like to come out of this with a hint of being patriotic and serving their constitutional obligations, to look into this further and, I believe, ultimately remove the president from office.
Well, already Putin has been very successful in in completely crippling and hobbling the FBI. As you know, David Rothkopf, the president, has attacked the FBI and the Justice Department, not anymore because he's got his guy in there. But the what I've learned from FBI people, particularly in the counterintelligence side, is that you cannot. If you found out, David, that there was a Russian spy living next door to you and you had credible evidence to support that, if you took that information to the FBI, they would not want to touch it with a barge pole. They are so terrified of even mentioning Russia that they steer clear of anything to do with Russia. So their mission in terms of protecting the United States, they've been intimidated by the Trump administration. And furthermore, the Trump people, particularly this horrible new deputy assistant attorney general, the number two guy that they're trying to get in there, they go through the Federal Election Commission lists and find out who gave money to Democrats. Of course, you can't find out how much money the Koch brothers give because they do it through these dark vehicles like 501c4s, but average folk who donate to political campaigns, it's on the record, and the Trump administration look to see who has given money to the Democrats, and that's a career killer. This is what's going on.
Well, and that's right, and I think on a daily basis, what's happening is that the standards are being eroded, whether it's ethical standards, the president appointing his daughter or son-in-law to positions.
Sorry, you're breaking up there. Could you repeat what you said, Dave?
Well, I was simply saying that the president has systematically worked away at our standards and undermined them, whether it's ethical standards, violation of the Emoluments Clause, ethical standards, appointing his daughter or son-in-law to high positions, legal and national security standards, such as the national security community recommends against giving his son-in-law and his daughter a security clearance, and he does so anyway. Factors like you mentioned within the FBI, the work of the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in essentially quashing any efforts within the Senate to hold the president accountable, and essentially saying that that they will not convict the president in the event that the House submits a bill of impeachment, and on. And I think what we have to worry about is not just that all this has happened, but that there is an effort among Republicans to say the Mueller report is over. There were no crimes specifically committed, even though Mueller was told he could not indict the president. And even though he makes a very strong case for obstruction, and by the way, also makes a very strong case that Trump cooperated with the Russians, what's the message Trump's going to get from that? He's going to be encouraged. He will further lower the standards. He will further violate laws and undermine the rule of law in the United States. And the consequence of that is very scary to imagine. What if he wins re-election? What if you have 6 years of erosion of the rule of law like the past 2 years? What if you have 6 years in which the president places the interests of Russia and the views of the president of Russia ahead of those of his entire intelligence and law enforcement community? Who will be on top at the end there? It's a very disturbing scenario. And I have to tell you honestly, I'm not sure how it's going to work out. I'm not sure the good guys win in this. I'm not sure that American democracy, as we have known it, can survive this. I'm hopeful, but I'm not sure.
Well, when you said earlier, David Rothkopf, that 40% of the public support Trump, and that's largely due to Rupert Murdoch keeping them in a kind of bubble of delusion, where they're immune to facts and evidence, that still leaves 60%. So you have to ask yourself, what's wrong with the 60% majority? And the idea that so far the Republicans have pretty much smoked the Democrats, at least through the actions of Barr, you have to admit that they've done a pretty good job in suppressing this Mueller report, but it still exists. And unless and until the Democrats get the full report and know exactly what's in it, they are stymied in terms of going forward. And institutionally, they're afraid of the word impeachment. And as far as I can tell, the most damaging stuff comes from the fact that it's so clear that this man is out of control. He has neither the temperament or the judgment to be president of the United States. His aides have to stop him from doing crazy stuff. So that should be a powerful weapon against him. But that's exactly what Hillary Clinton ran on in the last election. And look where that got her.
Well, look, Hillary Clinton ran on it. It was early days. There was not as much evidence. Even the Mueller report with the redacted portions is extremely compelling. But you also have to note that at the end of the Mueller report, there's reference to something like a dozen ongoing investigations that Mueller has farmed out to other attorneys' offices in the United States. There are legal proceedings, therefore, that will look at the Trump Foundation, that will look at the Trump Organization, that will look at money laundering within the Trump Organization, that will look at tax fraud. Remember, his sister, who is a federal judge, had to step down from office because they were going to investigate Trump family tax fraud over the years, as brought out in that New York Times article that just won a Pulitzer Prize. That implicates Trump, obviously, as well. The House is going to investigate not just the Mueller findings, but areas that are outside of the Mueller findings, including money laundering, which is a central element of the way that the Trump Organization works. I think all of these things need to be pursued. But I also think that that majority of Americans who recognize that Trump is unfit for the presidency need to move the needle within the Democratic Party away from caution and, you know, fear of bringing this up, away from making the wrong analogy between this and the Clinton impeachment, and recognize that what Trump has done is light years worse than anything that Richard Nixon did. There are 10 counts of obstruction highlighted within the Mueller report that are greater than the kind of obstruction that Nixon contemplated. There was no element of this kind of cooperation with a foreign enemy of the type under Nixon. And the rampant corruption within the Trump administration, from serving friends of Trump to letting countries that do business with Trump get away with literally murdering American residents, as in the case of Jamal Khashoggi, and on and on. You know, we are at the beginning of making the case against Trump. And I have to say, while we may talk all we want about what an opinion poll says now, and by the way, the opinion polls are moving against Trump since the Mueller report, but whatever we may say about this in the moment, ultimately, history is going to be the judge. And history is going to judge this by the accumulated facts and by looking at things like the Mueller report. And I guarantee you that 50 years from now, people will look back on the administration of Donald Trump, and they will say that he is the most corrupt, unfit president to have served in that office until now. Now, what we have to do is we have to make sure that he is held accountable for that and that we don't make the same mistake again, and we don't let the Russians and others influence our election so that the same thing happens again. And I don't want to lose sight of that. There is a national security issue underlying all of this. And the 2020 elections are vulnerable to the depredations of groups like the Russians and support from groups like Trump.
Well, David Rothkopf, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who's a visiting professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And he's been a longtime contributor to Foreign Policy Magazine and was the CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group from 2012 to 2017. And his latest book is The Great Questions of Tomorrow. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the strongest evidence in the Mueller report revealing the Trump campaign's collusion with the Russians. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masterson. This is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Anders Aslan, who's a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. And his books include Europe's Growth Challenge, Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It. And his forthcoming book out in May is Russia's Crony Capitalism, The Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslan.
Thank you very much, Ian.
So, Anders, I obviously want to talk to you about the fact that the comedian, a comedian has won the presidency in Ukraine. And, of course, a comedian already had won the presidency in Guatemala and also in Italy. But or the co-presidency, I guess you could call it. But let's talk first about the strongest evidence in the Mueller report revealing the Trump campaign colluded with the Russians. Of course, how many times has Trump said no collusion, no collusion? And Barr has given him the excuse to say that, but it's certainly not the case. So what struck you most about the new evidence about Manafort's meeting with Konstantin Kilimnik, the GRU officer?
Well, what struck me most is that it was a steady traffic that Manafort, through his deputy Rick Gates, passed on to Kilimnik, internal polling data all the time to Kilimnik. And the conclusion that is missing in the Mueller report, and I don't understand why, is that we all know that Kilimnik is a GRU officer. The evidence is overwhelming, and Mueller does present contradictory evidence about it. It makes it likely that he's a Russian intelligence officer, but not GRU. And it was GRU that did the hacking, which is well documented, and also essentially ran the internet research agency, the Troll Factory in Petersburg. So what Manafort did is that he worked as a GRU agent, providing polling data so that they knew where to do what, so that they would have the most impact on the U.S. election. In return, Manafort repeatedly worked on a peace plan. We knew both activities occurred before, but not that they were regular activities. So to my mind, the obvious conclusion that Mueller should have drawn from these observations is that Manafort colluded with GRU in order to change the election outcome in the United States through the social network activities and the GRU hacking, and also assisted Russia with having a peace plan that suited Moscow. And strangely, Mueller believes that this was done with former President Yanukovych, when we know from many sources that it's done together with the Kremlin. So this is poor detective work, poor analysis, and feeble or missing conclusions. I think it's a shame.
Well, it's pretty hard to understand why Mueller, in one of his earlier indictments of the GRU officers, a whole bunch of them, that he indicted by name. And that obviously upset Putin, because what had happened was that Dutch intelligence had managed to slave a camera that is at the GRU's booth at the Internet Research Agency, the shop in St. Petersburg that Putin's cook, Prigozhin, ran. As every employee came in, they had to pass through the metal detector, and the GRU officer there would check their ID against their face. And all of this went straight to Dutch intelligence and on to the CIA. And that's how Mueller was able to identify all of these people by name, not by their nom de plume or their cover names, you know. So it's pretty amazing that the resources of U.S. intelligence were there for Mueller, but the conclusions are so lame.
Indeed. I can't understand it. It looks very much as political interference, or that Mueller has not had sufficient integrity. So I think that Mueller comes out very badly from that. What we all had expected is that there would be much more information than we knew before. There is more information, but it's not the critical information. On the contrary, we knew much more. For example, Cambridge Analytica, that played an important role in this and has been forced to close down, is not mentioned. It's simply ignored. All Trump's finances, we have wondered what would come out. It has been rumored that Mueller had subpoenaed his tax returns and that he has subpoenaed Deutsche Bank about $1 billion loan to Trump 2008 and 2016. There's nothing about it in the report. So this looks like a sort of well-written cover-up.
Well, we can certainly, I don't know about Mueller's integrity, but you can certainly look at Barr's integrity, and he's repeating what he did for George H.W. Bush in covering up Iran-Contra. It's almost an exact replay. It's hard to know what his motives are. Anders, there's a very interesting article in Sunday's New York Times titled "Prodded by Putin, Russians Sought Back Channels to Trump Through the Business World." And we know that Putin regulates the oligarchs and he uses the Siloviki, the intelligence people, to do that. I believe that there's literally a Russian intelligence officer sitting outside of the offices of all of these powerful and incredibly wealthy oligarchs. But in this New York Times article on Sunday, it refers to how Kirill Dmitriev, the head of Russia's sovereign wealth fund, who's close to Putin, he contacted a hedge fund guy that works with Jared Kushner. And basically, knowing that Kushner is susceptible to the need for money because of his bad investments at 665 Fifth Avenue, he was obviously offering the lure of the Russia's sovereign wealth fund as a way to get close to Trump. And that's the MO, isn't it, that we're talking about here. So do you think that the Russian oligarchs like Dmitriev and Deripaska and others are still being used to funnel money into the United States and bribe people? I don't know whether they've bribed Barr. I don't know who they've bribed. But my sense is that the bribing is still going on.
Indeed. And it's a very interesting, very in particular, in Piotr Avan, the president of Alpha Bank, in his testimony to the FBI. He seems to be the most upfront person of these. But he said that Putin had told the big businessmen at his meeting with them at the end of 2016 in the Kremlin that he had called on those who had such resources to develop back channels to the Trump administration. And Piotr Avan then reports that he had tried to do so, but he had failed. Kirill Dmitriev, as you mentioned, he went to see Eric Prince on the advice of his hedge founder, George Nader, who's close to Kushner. But Kirill Dmitriev then returned to Nader and says that Eric Prince is simply too dumb to deal with, so that he wants a person who has a better brain than Eric Prince, who's the brother of
Betsy DeVos, right,
the Secretary of Education and owner of, or former owner of Blackwater, the rather frightful security company that became infamous for its killings in Iraq. And then we have Sergei Gorkov, the head of Vnesheconom Bank, who manages to see Jared Kushner. And here Mueller rather flatly says that Kushner said that they talked about diplomacy, and Gorkov said that they talked about business, and then he leaves it at that. It's quite obvious that Gorkov came with some financial proposal to Kushner, but Mueller finds no reason even to pose the question or to dig into it. And it is like this, time and time again, Mueller accepts obvious contradictions and lies without investigating them further. And worst of all, he never asked Trump. He could have called on Trump to testify under oath, and he didn't do so. So this is really cover-up and a very disappointing product, regardless of who is responsible for the U.S. Failing to investigate these matters properly.
But, Anders Aslan, in terms of bribery, we know this is probably the most corrupt administration in American history, and that arguably the cabinet, Trump's cabinet, are a team of grifters. So, and we also know that some time back in a private conversation, the now Republican minority head of the House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy, in a conversation with Paul Ryan, then the majority leader of the House, said that, I swear to God, Rohrabacher and Trump are on Putin's payroll, at which point Paul Ryan said, well, let's keep that amongst ourselves. Now, is it possible that there are more people on Putin's payroll? You know, like maybe Devin Nunes, he made a rather mysterious trip to the Balkans. Montenegro seems to have been working for Deripaska. And as I mentioned earlier, it's not inconceivable that the Russians are still throwing money via the system, this kleptocratic system that you write about in your new book, where Putin regulates the oligarchs, and the oligarchs basically are cutouts, and they also are able to throw their vast amounts of money around, for, you know, since they've essentially looted the Russian economy.
Indeed. I mean, Deripaska is the best example. He has done Russia very substantial services in the U.S., together with Manafort. This $60 million or so that Deripaska gave to Manafort, it must be payment for Manafort's long service to the GRU, a question that Mueller finds no reason to investigate. Deripaska, as you mentioned, has essentially financed the GRU activities in Montenegro, which included an attempted coup a couple of years ago by GRU officers. And he has also played a major role in Armenia, buying strategic companies in Armenia. So a person like Deripaska, I would not call him a cutout for the Kremlin, but a person who's being pressed to do services for the Kremlin and then delivers generously so that he can get state subsidies and a lot of them. Kirill Dmitriev, he's a state employee. He's married to the best friend of Putin's daughter, Katya, seemingly his favorite daughter. And then Sergei Gorkov, who by the way, got sacked since he didn't do his job. He was simply a state employee. So we have different degrees of dependence of the Kremlin. But the problem is, if you have large resources in Russia, you are dependent on the Kremlin. Otherwise, you end up as we now see a very fine businessman, Michael Calvi, has been arrested for no reason whatsoever.
Well, that all goes back to Khodorkovsky, doesn't it, who was the richest of the oligarchs, and he had the temerity to actually want to support liberal politics, and Putin made an example of him.
Indeed.
So
this was in 2003 that Khodorkovsky was arrested. And after that, Russian business has become increasingly dependent on the Kremlin. And Putin utilizes this and For the last decade, Russia's GDP has grown only by 1% on average each year, and it's all too obvious that Putin just doesn't care.
So, Anderson, just in the last few minutes, let's turn to the elections in Ukraine, where it appears that the comedian who played at the average guy on a TV show that was very popular, who accidentally becomes president in the TV show. It's one of these cases where art is imitated life. And he beat out the chocolate tycoon Petro Poroshenko, the incumbent president. I don't know. It looks like from the exit polls he won by a substantial margin. As I mentioned earlier, it's not the first time a comedian has been elected. It happened in Guatemala and it also happened in Italy. But we know so little about this guy. We don't really know who's behind him, except for a Ukrainian billionaire, Ihor Kolomoisky. So what do you know about who's behind this guy? Because we know Russia's interfering in Ukraine. It's got all kinds of tentacles in Ukraine. So what's going on?
Well, this was, I'm in Ukraine once a month, so I follow it very closely indeed, and it seems that it was 73% for Zelensky and 25% for Poroshenko. And this was an election where Poroshenko only stood for army, faith, and language. He focused on the hardcore Ukrainian nationalists, and that's never more than one quarter of the population, while Zelensky focused on corruption, which is the big concern, that economic growth is not sufficient. So you can say that people said no to the bad way, low economic growth and a lot of corruption, and they opted for a hope. So we shouldn't say that Zelensky belongs to these populists that you mentioned in other countries. It's rather the emphasis that he's an unknown. He has some good and some bad relations. That Igor Kolomoisky, who has promoted him for his very popular television channel, is one of the worst, if not the worst, of the big oligarchs in Ukraine, who is not a Russian agent, but he simply thinks only of himself. And the question is, if Zelensky does anything for Kolomoisky, I think that Zelensky will be finished, because this is an anti-vote against Poroshenko and the old corrupt establishment, rather than a positive vote in favor of Zelensky. So Zelensky has to be very careful and move right. Otherwise, he will not do well in the parliamentary elections, which are now scheduled for the 27th of October. And Ukraine is approximately like France, that parliament and president are similarly important. And it's the parliament that controls the economy, while the president is in charge of law enforcement. So Zelensky needs to prove that he is strengthening law enforcement rather fast. The danger here then would be that he would have to instigate quite a few serious arrests of the people from the old corrupt elite in order to gain credibility.
Well, when I mentioned art imitating life in terms of Zelensky's fame as a result of him playing a president or an ordinary guy that becomes president in a popular TV show called Servant of the People, there's apparently a dream sequence in this TV show where Zelensky's presidential character then goes to parliament and grabs his bodyguard's weapons and massacres the lawmakers and says, and apparently the graphic then says, end of the old era. That's not exactly an endorsement of democratic values. But just in closing, my understanding...
It's more significant that all the three big oligarchs are being arrested in the series.
Right. Well, but I was just curious to know about how the role of what's going on in eastern Ukraine and this low-intensity warfare that Putin's engaged in. My understanding is that Putin doesn't want an all-out war with Ukraine because it would end up being he'd get bogged down in guerrilla warfare and the body bags would come back to Moscow. But he's getting it on the cheap by just destabilizing them. But nevertheless, the voters in Ukraine punished Poroshenko for failing to end the war against Russia. Now, is there any realistic chance that the Ukrainians could end that war? Because my understanding is that Putin wants to keep it going.
Yeah, I mean, the main question lies in the Kremlin. It's clear from official Russian statements by Lavrov and Putin himself from November last year that they are not prepared to do any negotiation until after the parliamentary elections and the formation of a new government that will probably happen in December. So we shouldn't hold your breath, our breath in that regard. Zelensky has no mandate to do anything on the economy until the parliamentary elections, the outcome of which we don't know. So the focus now is, will there be arrest or not? Will there be a new prosecutor general and anti-corruption prosecutor?
Well, Anders Aslan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Anders Aslan, who's a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva and Moscow and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. And his books include Europe's Growth Challenge and Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It. And his forthcoming book is Russia's Crony Capitalism, The Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the paradox that Mueller had this great team of investigators, but at the end of the day, they couldn't indict the person they're investigating.
That you want me to do? Yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah? Baby, why don't you tell me the truth?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Aziz Huq, who is a professor of law at the University of Chicago and a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. He's also the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And his latest book, co-authored with Tom Ginsburg, is How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziz Huq.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
So, Aziz, our earlier guest was suggesting when I asked about were the founding fathers prepared for somebody like a Donald Trump? And he said, well, yes, they were. The impeachment is mentioned a number of times in the Constitution. Yet we're at this peculiar situation now where the Democratic establishment is afraid to even use the word impeachment. And you can't impeach Trump based on the Mueller report because nobody's read it except for the people who compiled it in Mueller's team and Barr, who's essentially covered it up and censored it. So do you see a moment when there will be some clarity here, where the full report will be available for the Congress to make the judgment? Because I think it's pretty clear, in spite of what Barr has tried to spin, that Mueller intended this to go to the Congress. That is how, surely, the Founding Fathers intended things.
I think that there are two questions that are embedded in what you just said, Ian. The first is, how are senior members of the government, particularly the president, to be sanctioned if they commit serious wrongdoing? And the Constitution is not, in fact, clear on this question. It does lay out a procedure for impeachment, but the impeachment clause also envisages the possibility of criminal punishment after the fact. Nothing in the Constitution, however, precludes criminal prosecution of either a sitting cabinet member or a sitting president. It's only a legal opinion from the Justice Department, one from the 1970s and one from 2000, that takes off the board the possibility of a criminal prosecution of a sitting president. So the Constitution, in fact, can be glossed as allowing either impeachment or prosecution, although I think for Robert Mueller's purposes, he was appointed under regulations that bound him to observe the Justice Department's legal opinion. So he wasn't able to plausibly move forward with a prosecution of the president. So that's one thing to bear in mind. The second thing I think that's worth emphasizing is the redactions in the Mueller report are not so great that one cannot see substantial evidence of wrongdoing, not just on the part of senior members of the administration, but also on the part of the president himself. There are, as has been noted in many sources, 10 separate incidences of obstruction of justice, several of which are documented in the Mueller report in such a way as to demonstrate that all of the necessary facts and mental states required for the criminal law are satisfied. So I'm not convinced that the redactions, of which there will inevitably be some, given the fact that there was a grand jury involved, the fact that there's classified information involved, I'm not convinced that the redactions change what is materially important in the report, which is first that there was extensive Russian efforts to interfere and that there was not hostility but receptivity to those efforts on the part of the administration and the campaign. And second, that there was a series of criminal acts taken by both the president and by people under him that are credibly documented now by an independent and professional investigator. So my inclination is not to focus on the redactions. My inclination is to focus on what the report tells us, which I think is tremendously important, particularly considering it comes from Mueller.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary that Mueller, I don't know whether he rolled over for Barr or what. I mean, I've heard reports that Mueller initially, you know, a month before the report came out, went to Barr and said he wanted to indict the president for obstruction of justice, but it's against the rules. And we know the rules were brought in because of the excesses of Ken Starr, who impeached a Democratic president. And now those very same rules, ironically, are protecting a Republican president. But in any case, what I was told was that he was basically told, you know, you can't do it. And he knew that, of course. But had he gone ahead and tried to indict Trump under those same rules, he could have that information could have gone to the House and Senate, because under the rules, apparently, if the Attorney General turns down an indictment, that information has to go to the House and Senate. I don't know whether that's true or not. But what is true, and our previous guest made it really clear, since he knows both Kilimnik and Manafort well, having worked for many years in Ukraine when Manafort was there, is that the Russian Internet Research Agency, the Troll Farm, run by the GRU, where Mueller was able to indict a bunch of Russians, they targeted those three key states with the polling information that Manafort gave Kilimnik, and they pushed heavily the candidacy of Jill Stein, and she took enough votes away from Hillary Clinton in those three states to have Trump win. That's just one element of this fairly multi-pronged Russian assault on our democracy. So the whole thing just feels like a big denial, and I don't understand what the motives are for people like Barr and even Mueller, if he's a sort of co-conspirator in this regard, to try and bury one of the biggest political events in American history.
I would distinguish in a way that you are pulling together the approach that Mueller's taken and the approach that Barr's taken. I think it's really important to remember that throughout the campaign and through the early months of the Trump presidency, there were repeated denials, both directly from the president and also from his senior staff and campaign members, that any Russian interference in the election occurred and that there were any contacts of any sort between the campaign or the administration and Russian officials or proxies, cutouts for Russian officials. The Mueller report, I think, categorically and completely demolishes those claims. And one of the most striking tropes in the response, the backlash to the Mueller report, was that it was a waste of time. And this is something that's heard both from the White House and from congressional Republicans, where I think that because of the Mueller report, because of the investigation and the indictments, it is simply not possible to contest that Russian interference in the election occurred. To be sure, there are important arguments to be had about whether it was outcome determinative in any given state, but the fact that it occurred and the fact that there was receptivity and a failure to disclose that interference on the part of the campaign is no longer in any doubt. And that, I think, is a consequence of the Mueller investigation and the Mueller report. So that, I think, is something that people too easily forget. If it was not for the Mueller report, those facts would be contested. I think that the Barr approach, or Barr's incentives, or what's driving him, is essentially fidelity to a president who has reasons for not wanting the legitimacy of his 2016 win cast into doubt. Second, there are plainly questions of criminality, not just with respect to obstruction of justice, but with respect to potentially what those close to him, including what his family members may have done, and with respect to his behavior in the campaign around allegations made by Stormy Daniels and others in respect to sexual relations. All of these things entangle criminal acts on the part of the president and others. And the interest that Barr is pursuing is in focusing our attention on this idea of collusion, an idea that has no clear or determinate meaning, as a way of distracting from the plethora of information and damning information about criminal offenses, moral lapses, and ethical and constitutional violations that are documented in the Mueller report and that have been revealed in part because of investigations into people like Michael Cohen that the Mueller report catalyzed. So I think the reading the historical record or reading what's happened this far as a kind of failure, I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish about where we are today, but I think it fails to take seriously the very persuasive factual record, which essentially Trump and others cannot deny, that has been created. And it seems to me utterly counterproductive to ignore that really persuasive factual record and to fall into the rhetorical trap that is created by this no collusion slogan, right? It is to chase after a phantom criminal offense which actually doesn't exist, and to ignore the ample evidence of criminality, immorality, and a failure of constitutional faith that is now on the record. And I think that the criticism of Mueller as somehow being complicit falls into that trap. Mm-hmm. For what it's worth, I my own sense of Mueller is that he was placed in an extremely complicated ethical and legal position, given the formal legal restrictions on what he could do, and given the dynamics. The public right. dynamics over his investigation, right? The constant attacks, the polarization on it, and I don't know whether what he did was the best of all possible things, given the hand he was played, but it doesn't strike me as being an implausible, bad faith, or incompetent strategy that he's pursued.
Right.
Right. The fact is. That there is an immense amount of information about Russian interference, about the failure of the Trump campaign and the Trump administration to respond in a responsible way to that interference, and then a litany of criminal offenses that occurred, that is now in the public domain. And when people focus upon the redacted elements, the still redacted elements of the report, when they focus upon the possibility of collusion, right, which isn't even a thing. They fall in. One is falling into the rhetorical trap that the Trump administration is setting.
Well, Aziz Haque, I thank you very much, and I appreciate your joining us here today.
I thank you for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haque, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And his latest book, co-authored with Tom Ginsburg, is How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.